You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Welcome to Scuderia F1, the podcast that's always up to speed with the latest Formula One news. Follow us on Twitter at Scuderia F1 Pod and subscribe to the show on iTunes and Stitcher. Now, here are your hosts, Mark Daly and Kevin Laramie.
Hey everybody, what is up? Welcome to the podcast, as always up to speed with Formula One here on the Overtime Media Network. Mark Daly here, welcoming you back to the show this week, and I've got a special show for you. This is a little bit different than usual, and this is one that came together a little bit unexpectedly and quite quickly. Really looking forward to getting it out there so all of you can listen to it. And I should just warn you right now, this one runs really, really long. And so what I've decided to do, rather than play it in its full entirety, which runs about 2 hours in length, I'm going to break it up into two separate episodes of about 1 hour each. That way it becomes a little bit more easy to listen to. I really enjoyed doing it. I had a bunch of guys here into the studio this evening. One was Tim Horaney, who is the TSN F1 analyst. And for those of you who do not live in Canada, TSN is the ESPN affiliate station here who has the rights to Formula One. And also I had Mark and Gil from the F1 Flash podcast, which is also really cool because they are also Canadian guys. But even more interesting than that is that not only the other fellow Canadians doing an F1 podcast, Mark lives only just like a couple of miles away from me. So that was really cool. You know, we'd been aware of each other for a while, but it took a mutual friend of both of us to actually make the connection and introduce us to one another. And from there, this what we call the Canadian F1 Podcast Summit came together. So really enjoyable get-together that we had a little bit earlier this evening. And we really did cover a broad range of topics because we are in this sort of really fascinating in-between portion of the year. I mean, obviously, the 2019 World Championship is behind us, but the 2020 season is now literally less than 2 months away from us now, which is great. We're just only a couple of weeks away from winter testing, and from there things are really going to ramp up. So it's an exciting time of year to get everything rolling and really get back into the sport. And there really is a lot of things to look forward to and really delve into over the next couple of weeks, because it's a really kind of funny time in Formula One, because a year is a long period of time no matter which way you look at it. But in Formula One, the way that the speed at which the sport progresses, you know, no pun intended, a year is an extremely long period of time. And to be in this the stage that we're at right now, where the regulations are in essence frozen in anticipation of the complete shift into the new regs for 2021, is something that's completely unique in my experience. But before we go any further with that, and I throw it back to the roundtable that we had in the studio earlier this evening, I first want to talk to you guys about CryoFreeze, because living with chronic pain is the worst. It's more than a feeling of discomfort, because it can affect your whole life. Many of the listeners of Scuderia F1 probably have some type of pain that has prevented them from relaxing and sleeping or stopped them from exercising. Perhaps it's even been ongoing for a few weeks now and hasn't improved with any of the treatments that you've been trying. So enter Omax Health. If you're looking to get rid of nagging muscle and joint pain immediately while providing long-lasting recovery, then you need to try the natural breakthrough pain relief solution, CryoFreeze CBD Roll-On, developed by Omax Health. This non-prescription triple-action pain relief roll-on is specially formulated to block pain receptors, reduce inflammation, and improve muscle and joint flexibility. The best part is this 100% natural CBD-powered remedy works its magic within 10 minutes of application, and relief lasts up to 8 hours, which is much, much longer than the over-the-counter products. So here's the cool part. Omax Health is offering listeners of Scuderia F1 20% off a full bottle of CryoFreeze CBD Pain Relief Roll-On, plus free shipping. This discount also applies towards any products site-wide. So just go to omaxhealth.com today and enter code OVERTIME. That is omaxhealth.com and enter code OVERTIME to get 20% off CryoFreeze and site-wide savings. So you're still not sold? Okay, I can also tell you that pro athletes such as PGA Pro Golfer Kyle Stanley uses CryoFreeze CBD to recover both on and off the course. So go look at the product rep reviews. They've got 95% five-star reviews, page after page of customers saying that they've tried everything, and Omax CryoFreeze is so good that they are now buying it for their friends and family too. So anyone from athletes to Grandma Josie can benefit from this immediate pain relief. If you have a pain that won't go away, then you qualify for Omax CryoFreeze. Simply roll it on where it hurts and ice out the pain. No messy creams or horrible fragrances like some of those other products. CryoFreeze works within 10 minutes of application, improving physical training, recovery, and performance. So once again, go to omaxhealth.com and enter code OVERTIME to get 20% off CryoFreeze and site-wide savings. I'm telling you, this product is the real deal. So go to omaxhealth.com and enter code OVERTIME to get 20% off and site-wide. All right, well, time to get on with the show. I'm going to throw it back to the studio from a little bit earlier on this evening when I was joined by Mark and Gil from the Flash F1 podcast and Tim Haraney from TSN. So sit back and enjoy.
5, 4, 3... Hello and welcome to a very special Formula One edition here. This is not the regular show that you guys are listening to. Some people might recognize my voice, some people won't. So let's start off by introducing everybody in the room here. I'm going to start with you two guys here because you guys came as, I wouldn't say a package, but close enough.
A dynamic duo.
Dynamic duo.
I think that's a pretty fair assessment. Yeah, I'm Mark from the Flash F1 Canadian podcast with my co-host today.
And I'm Gil from also Flash F1, and I'm happy to be here.
Incredible. Awesome. I'm surprised we're here. We had a bit of an unexpected blanket of snow the last couple of days. And not to give away your location, but we had to hike through some snow to get here, but it was worth it.
Yeah, up in deepest, darkest Coquitlam, the uncouth wilderness of Coquitlam, as
absolutely.
They say. And of course, we got one more gentleman here across from me.
Yeah, my name's Tim Haraney. So I used to be a former professional race car driver, raced in Champ Car Atlantics, which is now Indy Lights, tested for Champ Car, which is now IndyCar. I was a part of the Renault Driver Development Program in 2003-04, raced for Porsche, FIA GT Championship, raced in 24 Hours of Daytona, a whole bunch of racing for sure, and then transitioned into the broadcasting network. So now I work for TSN. For those of you who don't know what TSN is, so it's the ESPN affiliate here in Canada, and they are the rights holders for Formula One, and my job is the F1 racing analyst for all of Canada. So I get to break some news every once in a while, which is kind of nice, but having a close relationship with our Canadian drivers and also with quite a few people within the F1 paddock, it's led me to this job. I also have a podcast on tsn.ca/auto-racing. It's called The Racing Pod.
Cool. And I'm last and certainly least. My name is Mark Daly. I'm the host of the Scuderia F1 podcast. And it was weird because, like we were talking just now, what are the odds of having two Canadian F1 podcasts in the same town, you know, same city? I mean, we're all, you know, three of us here all in kind of Coquitlam, so it's a little bit odd.
We knew about the Racing Pod, but we thought that maybe we were doing Canadian motorsports fans a favor by creating a Canadian F1 podcast. And then a mutual friend of ours, Mark Victor, had reached out at one point and said, hey, my friend Mark, also in Coquitlam, does a Formula One podcast. I was like, come on, because I knew of your podcast, but I had no idea it was Canadian, let alone based in Coquitlam, just kilometers from my house.
I know, that's funny. Victor's a really cool guy, by the way. That's
absolutely
awesome. All right. Well, let's do what we came here to do tonight. And again, it's very fitting because less than a mile away from where we're sitting in the studio right now is the ghost of the old Westwood Motorsport Park for people that know a little bit about Canadian motorsport history. Sterling Moss was the course ambassador. There's a really cool video on YouTube if you can find it. It's way back from filmed in the late 60s or something like that. And it's about a 2 or 3 minute video. And you see Sterling going around the course, you know, with like a suit and a tie on and everything, like he's barely even breaking a sweat. And, you know, you got the really groovy 60s music, so that's pretty awesome. Anyway, so we have a lot of ground to cover tonight. We are, of course, in between two Formula One World Championships. 2019 is just behind us. 2020 around the corner. We got winter testing coming up in about less than 4 weeks from now. So slowly but surely, We're getting back to the exciting part of the year. So why don't we go back and just, let's 2019 I found to be a fascinating year in Formula One on many levels. So I think we'd be a little bit remiss if we didn't backtrack a little bit and talk about 2019 before we go into what we're expecting this year and what how the 2020 World Championship might shape up. So, Tim, what were your thoughts and your judgment on the 2019 World Championship?
Well, it started off really boring. I mean, let's not... You know, sugarcoat it. It was bad. It was a bad start to the season. But as things started to gain some steam and pick up, we got to witness, I think, one of the teasers, I would say, heading into what 2020 could look like. Because for the first, I would say, 6 to 7 races, it was all Mercedes, obviously. That's where Lewis Hamilton was able to open up his lead in the championship, and that's basically where he won the driver's title, in all honesty. Mm-hmm. Like, he didn't really win it towards the end because Ferrari came on strong, Red Bull started to get their act together, and I really think that heading into 2020, I think that the last 6 races of the 2019 season is what 2020 is going to look like.
Well, that's what I'm really hoping for, because you made a good point there. And for me, when we went through that first 7-8 races of the year, it wasn't so much, is Lewis Hamilton going to win the World Championship in 2019, but when? It was just a question of time. And I thought it was really disappointing, because Ferrari really teased us, because they came out winter testing last year, a second to second half lap or faster than everyone else. It took a Mercedes a little bit of time to get the car dialed in last year. Red Bull, they struggled a little bit in testing. Max didn't really get a lot of time because I think Gasly smashed up one of the cars. Yeah, and they didn't have enough spare parts. So I think it really gave us a bit of a false indication. But Mark, you're looking very thoughtful there.
I'm just processing. Yeah. But I agree. And it's funny because I recall last season, and I recall after 8 races. And again, I tend to be a bit of a Lewis Hamilton booster, but after 8 races, I'd actually recorded a monologue that was, this is just another one of those years. It's going to be another Mercedes dominant performance from the beginning to the end. It's going to be a question of not if, but when Hamilton wins the title. I didn't know that there was going to be anything else to root for, but we had that run of races in the middle of the season, maybe starting with Austria and Hungary and Belgium and Germany and Britain, where we had this run of 5 or 6 great races, and it changed the entire narrative and dynamic of the season. So I don't know. I thought it was an interesting season. I don't know if it was a classic, although there was perhaps some classic races, but I thought things like, and Gil and I were talking about this earlier today as well. I thought even the storyline and the narrative associated with Honda really regrouping and becoming a force with Red Bull was an interesting story, because it builds a more compelling narrative going into 2020. But yeah, I thought it was an interesting season, but it started so poor and I was getting so frustrated by the second month of the season that it was just going to be more of what we'd seen in 17-18. And that wasn't necessarily the case.
Yeah. Well, going back to, many, many moons ago, but going through those first 7-8 races of the year, I started having flashbacks of when I was a kid. I was thinking, was it 88, 89, when McLaren with Prost and Senna won every single race?
Yeah, run away with it, the two of them. It kind of reminded me of also like the Mercedes era of like Rosberg and Hamilton, like 14, 15, 16. I thought we were in for another sort of Bottas Hamilton, but yeah, Valtteri just couldn't really muster anything up to kind of compete against Lewis. And obviously we're going to talk about that later on the show, but I think once Ferrari really started to figure out the front of the car and questionable tactics, maybe with the engine, some of the things I've heard, it's just, that's racing, it's Formula One, right? But at the end of the day, I thought that, you know, once Ferrari really started to get the downforce levels figured out on the car, you know, we really started to see that team come to life.
Well, the Ferrari was a real interesting story, that that gray area that they really pushed it with the engine, what was legal and what wasn't. But it's funny because, you have Max, who always comes out, and Max is, being Dutch myself, I understand like the mindset, but I just love how he just, it's just black and white. No, they're cheaters. He just came out and said that they were cheaters. But, you have Charles saying, he's not on the team. He doesn't know what he's talking about. You have Seb saying that, he's just not mature or professional. Yeah. And you have Binotto saying, if we were doing something illegal, we would have been caught by now. So But it was interesting that once all that extra scrutiny came in, some of that straight line performance we saw at Spa and at Monza especially, it all of a sudden it wasn't quite as apparent. But Gil, I see that you're ready to weigh in here.
No, not me. I was just wanting to express, like, for me personally, the start of the 2019 season, there was a lot of hype around Leclerc, Ferrari. We talk about Ferrari's team orders. It's a new, everything's new around that team for that season for 2019. Binotto is a team principal. You've got the starting relationship between Vettel and Leclerc. All the talk about Leclerc being the number one driver, and you've got Mercedes, you've got Bottas and Hamilton. They've got one and two for however many races. So that excited me for the beginning of the race, and then I think it petered out after mid-season break or after the races that Mark was just talking about. So,
passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
The Capital Ideas podcast now has a new monthly edition hosted by Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin. Investment professionals reveal their best mentors, how they find their next great idea, and a few funny stories. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. American Funds Distributors, Inc.
So, Tim, I don't think it's any stretch of the imagination to say that Charles Leclerc is the real deal. But as a racing driver yourself, what is it that makes Charles special? Because we saw him, I mean, first year in Ferrari, I mean, he was amazing. I mean, he should have won in Bahrain. But go back to 2018, driving that Sauber C37, obviously wasn't one of the greatest cars on the grid that year. But but looking at it as the from the point of view as a racing driver, what is it that makes Charles good? What makes Charles Charles?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. Adaptation being one of them. And I would say one lap consistency with not many mistakes. I mean, every racing driver in a qualifying lap is going to make a mistake. There's usually no point at which you don't make a mistake in a qualifying lap, in all honesty. I mean, sometimes you'll get the perfect lap, but those are few and far between. I also would go back and take a look at the Formula 2. Now, a lot of people don't really understand, well, at the time, I guess it was GP2, but a lot of people don't really understand just how difficult those cars are to drive, and the ever-changing Pirelli tires that those young drivers have to deal with. Their mentality when they come into Formula 2 is to be as aggressive as possible, you know, push the car to its limits. The problem is with the F2 tire is that you can't treat it like that. You can't treat it like a normal race tire. You have to really finesse, you have to baby it, and it goes against everything as a racing driver that you're taught. You're taught to always be aggressive, and you're taught to always push. With the F2 tire, you can't really do that. There are times that you can, but there are a lot of times where you just cannot, and you just need to kind of hang in and kind of just let the race kind of develop the way it's going to, and then attack with whatever tire you have left. Now, when you get the understanding of how that tire works and how the deg works on the tire, you take that information with you and you transfer it into Formula One. You see a lot of these young drivers who are coming up, like Lando Norris. People will say whatever they want about Pierre Gasly, but Gasly he's an awesome driver. Alex Albon, he's the real deal. And you kind of take a look at how quickly they've been able to get up to speed in an F1 car in their age. So take into account, like, what Norris was, what, 19 this year, right? Yep. When I was 19, I was still in, like, Formula Renault. Like, you know, it just, there's a huge difference in the way these guys are training nowadays and the way they're learning. As for Charles Leclerc, just having that knowledge and how the tire actually works, experiencing that, and then taking that knowledge into Formula One, I really think that's how he was able to do so well in those Sauber days, for sure.
The other thing that really strikes me about Charles is that despite all the hype, and he still seems to be an incredibly grounded, he seems like a very relatable, like very normal guy.
And absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, not to say that a lot of these guys, you know, come across as really swollen egos, but to me, I mean, some do, some don't. But I mean, Charles, I find, is a very relatable person. So, Mark, I'm going to throw it over to you now. Going into 2020, is Charles Leclerc the undisputed number one driver at Ferrari?
Ooh, coming in strong. You didn't even wait. You came in right over the top with that one.
I was hoping I wasn't going to get that. So I have feelings on that. And I would like to say it's tough because on the one hand, I think on paper he is, simply because he has a contract beyond this year and Sebastian Vettel doesn't have a contract beyond this year. And I don't even know if there's been negotiations between Vettel's camp and Ferrari.
It's been very silent. That deal
100%. Yep. It's been very, very, very quiet. And especially when you consider Vettel's performance last year, you know, he finished second in the championship in 17. He finished second in the championship in 18. He finished fifth last year. He finished behind his teammate Leclerc. He finished behind Verstappen, driving that Honda-powered Red Bull, which I think probably surprised a lot of people. So even if Ferrari don't say it, I think internally that's how they're going to strategize it. I just don't know that as a professional courtesy, they're going to want to publicly proclaim that he's the number one, but I think their actions will speak louder than words. So even if they're not willing to say it, and maybe they withdraw a lot of the team orders that we saw in the first half of the season, I think he has to be, because this is the driver that they've decided to invest in for the next 5 years, and they've made no such proclamation about Sebastian Vettel.
I think it's going to be a very similar situation with Charles and Seb as it was with Max and Danny Ricciardo at Red Bull. They may not come out and say it's like you know, like right out, flat out in public. But I think for Seb, very much like Danny Rick, that the signs are there that that was Max's team, because when Ricciardo said he was going to Red Bull, it's like, oh my God, that's a real shock. But when you think, oh no, that makes perfect sense, because, you know, he can see some of the writing on the wall. And then to see some of that behind the scenes footage in that F1 Drive to Survive series that came out on Netflix about a year ago, it was kind of interesting to see some of these discussions and see like Christian Horner talking to like Ricciardo and to Ricciardo's parents, and then just kind of see the stuff that, you know, we all kind of, you know goes on behind the scenes, but it's fascinating.
There's more than that that goes on, but we can't see. I think Ferrari wants, like, from my knowledge and from the people I've spoken with, like Ferrari wants to have Seb back. Like, there's no question about that. I think it all comes down to how much and what kind of circumstances he's going to be put into. Where are the team orders going to lay? Who's going to get number one treatment? I think a lot of that is going to come down, and Sebastian's going to have to, he's going to have to make a decision, either maybe retire, which he probably could. He's a four-time world champion. He's got enough money to last him and his family, like, for who knows how long. And
generations.
He really doesn't have, I mean, yes, for him, he wants to win at Ferrari. He wants to win a championship. He wants to kind of emulate, you know, his hero, like Michael Schumacher and all of that. But at the end of the day, I mean, he really doesn't have much to prove. He's a four-time Formula One world champion.
Well, the one thing that really surprises me is just going back to the start of 2018. We go into 2018, you have Lewis Hamilton, four-time world champion. You have Sebastian Vettel, four-time world champion. I was just like, okay, who's going to be the first of five? And now all of a sudden, it seems like it's been like on hyperspace. Like all of a sudden, we're just like, oh my God, this could be the year that Lewis ties Michael Schumacher's record of seven world championships. But just sticking on the topic of Sebastian Vettel, has the window of opportunity closed on Seb? Is there an opportunity still for him to win a world championship? Or you want to take that one? You're a brave man.
I know. I was sitting there thinking about it.
You know what? I think I had a conversation with Mark earlier today. I think there's several factors for Sebastian to win a championship again. Like I said earlier, you know, there's a new team principal. There's new, you know, the car, the aerodynamics, where they changed the wing in the beginning of the season. He's got a new relationship with Leclerc, how they're going to play off each other and supporting each other on the track. Ferrari needs to give him the car to be a champion. He's got the skills. He knows how to drive. He's been a champion before. Mm-hmm. If you don't give their driver the right tools, the right coaching, the right team environment, how can they? Mercedes has been consistent with Hamilton and Bottas.
It's been ridiculous how good they've been
exactly.
over the years.
Yeah. So whether Bottas is, you know, hasn't won a championship yet, just a supporting role, just the way that Mercedes keeps that very tight knit for Hamilton to thrive. Mm-hmm. If they're going to support Vettel into becoming another champion, they need to give him the tools. If they're going to be investing the younger foe, Leclerc, and pushing him to be the champion going forward, then they just got to just make that clear. Just like say, you know, Vettel, we're gonna just make Leclerc the number one driver. You know, your time is up. What do you want to do?
Gil, I agree. And I kind of want to play off of Tim's thoughts on this one, because neither of us have ever been in that situation where there's a garage and there's a team that's supporting two drivers. And I think I've heard in a lot of interviews, especially through Beyond the Grid, a lot of the drivers talk about the fact that there is a real difference in dynamic between being the number one driver and being the number two driver in terms of resources and pressures and support from the team. But from your perspective, what does that actually mean to be a number one driver? So if Charles Leclerc is the number one driver, how does that impact Vettel? Like, how is his experience on that team different than it would be if he was Leclerc?
I think one of the biggest things about being a number one driver is experience. Like, what's your experience level like? What is your winning percentage like as well, right? Because it always comes down to, there's 10 seconds left on the shot clock. It's the fourth quarter. Game is tied. Who are you going to give the ball to? Yeah. Kyle Lowry or Kawhi Leonard?
Yeah.
Right. And it's kind of one of those situations where in racing, it's like, hey, we got a lot on the line here and we need to win. Yeah. And we need to win right now because it's our time and it's our chance. And we're just hanging on. So who are we going to give that opportunity to? We're going to give it to the person who's more experienced and who we know can deliver a lap when we need it? Or do we give it to someone who's still kind of learning and coming along? You saw that with Charles Leclerc at the start of the 2019 season. You saw him make his mistakes. Mm. You saw him learn, right, from those mistakes. If you go all the way back to the Hungarian Grand Prix, at the end of that race, he was nowhere near Sebastian Vettel in that race in terms of lap times and finishing position. He was so far off Vettel's pace, it wasn't even funny. He had said that, you know, he was going to go away for the summer break, and he was going to try and figure out what Sebastian was doing during the races compared to what he was doing during the races. And it always comes back to tires, and everyone's going to get so sick and tired of me talking about tires, but that's where it starts, and it always starts with the tires. And whatever Charles Leclerc was able to do during that summer break, he came back a totally different race driver. And it's at that point where you saw Ferrari start to take a closer look at, hey, we really have a special kid here. It's only taken him XYZ amount of races, and now he's on the same pace, if not faster, than Vettel with the exact same equipment. We need to start investing in this kid, and we need to start doing it now.
Yeah. Well, that's why it makes Charles's comments earlier this week that more fascinating, because he says he still believes that Seb is quicker in race trim. So that's an interesting comment that he made.
Mind games or just being polite or even just playing the team game, right? Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, he's a smart guy, right? if I'm Charles Leclerc, I want harmony within the Ferrari camp, because we know what can happen outside of that camp when people start to find out that there isn't harmony inside it, right? Once you start getting news publications starting to hear about, you know, there's uncertainty between Sebastian Vettel and Charles Leclerc. Oh, there's infighting. And, you know, that tends to really start to fracture a team. And you saw it with Lewis Hamilton and Nico Rosberg. A perfect example.
That was toxic, to say the least. But I thought that they handled the aftermath of the accident in Brazil very, very well.
I agree.
So they do it behind closed doors. You talk with Charles. You talk with Seb. Yeah. You know, you talk with them both in the same room. Totally. And then you just come out. And all you say publicly is, We've dealt with it in-house rather than, you know, throwing one of them under the bus publicly, which I think, you know, really could shatter, you know, somebody's, you know, shatter those relationships, really start the fire.
Absolutely. And all credit has to be handed to the people behind the scenes, like Matteo Bonotto. Like, you have to give that guy some, I know, you know, and you know what? I think he gets a lot of flack thrown at him the past season with some of the mistakes that were made with pit stop strategy, all the things happening behind closed doors. But then if you go back to Maurizio Arrivabene, I mean, like, I think in terms of how the team is run, I think it's night and day difference. And if you're a Ferrari fan, I think you really have to be happy with what Matteo Bonotto has been able to do. And plus, try to keep these two guys happy.
Well, I think for me, the big difference between Arrivabene and Bonotto is that those pit wall mistakes are still there, but they seem to be reacting and learning from those things a lot quicker than they were in the several years previous when Arrivabene was the number one guy there. So I want to dial back here and just go a little bit back in the discussion here. We started off talking about Mercedes and we talked about, you know, Bottas. And I want to put this one out here because this is going to be one of the talking points, because we've seen Charles sign a long-term deal to 2024. Max is under contract to 2023. So Sebastian, we know, is out of contract this year, as is Valtteri Bottas. So, and this term has been thrown out there a little bit over the past month or two. But does Bottas 2.0 have what it takes to beat Lewis Hamilton, or is 2020 going to be Valtteri's last year at Mercedes?
Who's taking that one? No, you haven't said questions much. You're up first, Gil.
Well, I firmly believe that Bottas doesn't have what it takes to... Being partnered with Hamilton, that's a big shadow to kind of overtake. So... But Mercedes team has been very good to both of them. They worked, Bottas and Hamilton have a good working relationship together, I feel. You know, I just don't think Bottas has it in him or to compete and surpass Lewis Hamilton. Lewis Hamilton's on a different level. Mm-hmm. Like he's the Tiger Woods of Formula One. Mm-hmm. The way he's consistent in conserving tires, his drivability, the way he's calculating on the track.
His racecraft.
Yeah, his racecraft. But I don't see that from Bottas. Like, it doesn't jump out at me. And I don't think he's got what it takes to be a number one driver for Mercedes or surpassing Hamilton. Yeah. That's just me saying that. He's a good supporter. He's good for the team. They've got a great working relationship. Mm-hmm. But Hamilton is on a different level. Partnering those two together are good and bad. Like, good for the team, bad for Bottas.
It's great for the team because you have a driver next to Hamilton in that garage who's not competing in psychological warfare with
Rosberg and Hamilton.
The team couldn't contain the animosity and the toxic relationship, and it spilled out into public. And fortunately, they continue to win drivers' titles and constructors' titles. But ultimately, it took one of the two of them to retire for them to allow that garage to simmer back down again. But I think, and you and I talked about this before, I love Valtteri Bottas, and I think he's a tremendously consistent driver. But I don't think he's going to be in a Mercedes driving seat if Hamilton's not there. Because if Hamilton left and he departed and he went to Ferrari, and we'll talk about that potentially later, but maybe he's there, but he's always going to be your B driver. Because if I'm Mercedes, I still have to take my product, which is this championship winning racing team, and I have to sell it to sponsors, and I have to sell it to the broader Mercedes organization that we're going to invest this amount of money and we're going to build a team around this guy. I don't see them building a team and marketing a sponsorship package around Valtteri Bottas. And I love him, but I try to think about this guy. I don't know what his identity is. I don't know what his personality is. He's very level-headed. He's cool as a cucumber, all those cliches. Yeah. But psychologically, I don't think he's in a position to compete with Hamilton. And if he had to, I fear that Hamilton would destroy him.
And I don't know his goals either. Like, I think his goal is, yes, to be a championship driver like any other Formula One racer. But it's not clear to me that that's what he's striving for. Like, it doesn't show on the track. I know he's trying. Not like Rosberg. It was clear. Nico Rosberg wanted to win a championship just like his father.
At all costs.
Yep. Once he won that, he was out. He didn't care afterwards after that. Yeah. So
it was a real shock that he retired, like, what, it was a week after?
I wasn't shocked at that. I knew that, was, like, for me, I saw that in him. That's his goal. Not that I know Rosberg personally, but it just, he wanted to be a world champion like his father. And once he got that, he was like, he's been battling with Lewis for so long trying to get that championship. Yeah. However many years did he lose out to Hamilton until he
14 and until came he, down to the wire and, 15 got until he, the until wire, he 16.
Yeah, until that season where he was a bit shady in the Monaco kind of, you know, qualifying era when he backed up all the cars from going off the runoff, and that's when it, you know, all the flak came down on him. And you know, I think Bottas just needs to have a clear goal in mind. But I agree with you. I don't think Mercedes is going to push him to be the number one driver, regardless of Hamilton.
I think Hamilton's happy having him as a teammate because he's not pushing Hamilton psychologically. Yep. He's not battling Hamilton in the media. Yep. He's not battling him with snippets in the press and on podcasts and in TV interviews. He's collective. He's a professional. He's cool. He's collected. He's a professional on the racetrack. And he doesn't push Hamilton any harder than Hamilton needs to be pushed to win a championship.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
I think Bottas can beat Lewis. Here's why I say that. Yeah,
interesting.
Here we go. Yeah. Well, you know, let's talk about the 2019 season when Valtteri was on, dialed in. He was faster than Lewis. Lewis couldn't catch him. Couldn't.
Australia, for example.
Yeah. Couldn't touch him.
Yeah. Yeah.
Couldn't touch him.
And Hamilton's commented on how worried he was after the first two or three races. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. Should have been. What Valtteri's problem is himself. He gets in his own way. And I think if Mercedes builds a car for the 2020 season, that Valtteri doesn't need to worry too much about how to drive it, that it actually fits his driving style, I think he takes it right to Lewis. And I don't think he can lose, in all honesty. I think if Valtteri's able to get out of his own way, if he's able to be consistent and not crash like he has in 2019, and some of the mistakes that he did make over the 2019 season that really did end up costing him leverage in the Drivers' Championship, I think he can take it to him. I honestly do believe that. Valtteri is quick. I think he's his own worst enemy at the end of the day.
Yeah. Well, we all know that there are certain tracks where Valtteri is very good.
Yeah.
Russia is one. Definitely. Azerbaijan is another one. I mean, there's a number of tracks. It's just being able to do it more consistently. Yeah. That's why. Sorry, go ahead.
No, so, you know, Russia is an interesting one that you say, because a lot of the drivers get to Russia, that's not a typical street track. It's not even a typical racetrack. The asphalt and the track surface just makes it so slippery, and there's not a lot of grip, and drivers really struggle with the fact that if the track doesn't develop and rubber doesn't get embedded into the actual pavement and grip levels don't actually start to come up, you know, that really confuses a lot of racing drivers, because you tend to start to change the car with how the track is starting to come towards you. But for a driver to actually just go out and be able to take what he has or she has and adapt that driving style to the way that the track surface actually is a very hard thing to do. And it's actually really impressive. And it's one of the reasons why I think that Valtteri Bottas could possibly take it to Lewis this season.
Well, if he comes out like he did in Australia last year, and he can reproduce
keep that consistency, right? He's got to keep that consistency, and I honestly think he can take it to him.
So what do you think changed in Bottas this year? Because we had that great run, for a great Mercedes run where there was 1-2 for five consecutive races, and there was all this talk about Valtteri Bottas 2.0, and the British press picked that up and you heard it everywhere, and it dropped off so fast. But what changed at race six in Bottas? Was it
shaved.
Mental?
All about the razor. No, I think at the end of the day, it's all mental for him. Yeah. I think one bad... And that's why I say he's got to get out of his own way, I think, because it's one bad slip up and it just kind of snowballs for him. And he's not the only racing driver that does that, where they have, you know, a bad race weekend and that kind of snowballs into another bad race weekend and then another one. And it takes him so much mental effort just to get out of it, to get back on pace again. It takes a lot of confidence. And the problem is that you can't keep putting yourself into those situations because that's what's going to bring you down if that's the type of racing driver you are, which it actually kind of looks like Valtteri Bottas is.
Yeah. I don't have a lot of like experience with professional racing drivers, but I do with a lot of elite level soccer players with the Canadian national team, Major League Soccer, mm-hmm. and guys like that. And it's interesting watching them in games, watching them like off the pitch, in the dressing room or on the practice field. And it is really interesting when they get in the rhythm and you can tell a guy that just really, you know, he's found his mojo, just how easy things come. And then you can see it when a guy's struggling. It's just like there's no matter how hard they try, it just isn't going for them. And then all of a sudden it just starts going no matter what it is. And it's fascinating.
Yeah. You know, it's a perfect point that you make, you know, marrying it with another sport. And it's one of the things that I like to try and do. Is trying to explain to people who do watch Formula One but don't really understand it at the same point is that, let's say, you know, you're an NBA player and you're in a massive shooting slump and you're like, whoa, this guy was just like, you know, Danny Green was lighting it up in the regular season, and then once he gets into the playoffs, it's like, hold on a second, where did Danny Green go? What's going on here, right? It's kind of the exact same thing as a racing driver. It's confidence in it, and in sports, it's all the same that way. It's all such a psychological game for all of these athletes. You know, they're at the pinnacle, and at the end of the day, it's all psychological that makes or breaks you. And at the end of the day, right?
And sometimes it's like walking that really fine line. Yeah. You know, you either you have it or you don't. Okay, I want to talk now a little about Lewis Hamilton, and well, we haven't we haven't held anything back so far, so we're going to keep up with like the hard questions. So we know Lewis is out of contract at Mercedes after the end of this year. So does Lewis put contract hold or talks on hold until later into the year until he knows how the World Championship is going? And if it looks like he wins World Championship number 7 with Mercedes, do we possibly see him move to Ferrari to win World Championship number 8? I mean, to tie Michael Schumacher and then beat the guy who set all those records at Ferrari and then beat his records in a Ferrari?
Yeah.
So isn't that kind of stuff dreams are made of?
Talking to him a couple months ago, I got the sense that, you know, he really wanted to get a contract sorted out with Mercedes. I was in an interview with him, and he had talked a lot about wanting to be, when his F1 career was over, really wanting to be a part of the Daimler Group and being a big part of helping Mercedes try and grow the brand even more than what it is, and just kind of being that brand ambassador for them when he leaves F1. And he did speak openly to me about it. And I had brought that same question up to Toto Wolff, and even Toto was like, you know, obviously we want to keep Lewis around, but we want to keep him around once he retires. We want him in the Daimler Group. We want him a part of what we're trying to do here. So to hear all of that and then learning about him taking a meeting with you know, execs over at FCA and learning about, you know, maybe Ferrari having some interest in him coming on, there is no way he's going to Ferrari. There is absolutely no chance Lewis Hamilton goes to Ferrari. Let's think about it. You got Charles Leclerc, who's their bread and butter right now at Ferrari. If you're Lewis Hamilton and you leave Mercedes and you go over to Ferrari, you want to talk about a war between two drivers? Because I'll tell you what, you're going to get one, right? And if you're Ferrari, I don't think you want that.
No, right? Well, Max even came out and said that was one of the reasons why he wouldn't want to go to Ferrari.
Absolutely. They've got their guys. They've got Charles Leclerc. They've got Sebastian Vettel. They want to try and keep Sebastian Vettel. I think Lewis stays at Mercedes. I think he's going to get a big contract. And I think for him, he wants to get this done. He wants to get this done this season. I think he wants to get it done before the season even begins, if not first six races in, just try and get something hammered out. So psychologically for him, that's a weight off his shoulders, and he knows where he's going to be with his future. I think that's a huge part for Lewis. And then there's always incentives that he can try and build into a contract as well. Like, hey, let's say I do win, you know, my seventh Formula One World Championship, and I tie Michael Schumacher. That's an extra $30 million for this year, or something like that. There is no reason to say that that can't be built into these Formula One contracts.
Yeah. Interesting, because I don't know if I don't for me I don't see him wanting to pull that trigger early. Let him wait it out and say, "Oh, this is what I'm doing for the season," and then that just puts a bit more solidarity into the contract later into the year. Like, hey, I'm this close to winning this season's championship. When the papers and the contracts are down, this is where it's like, okay, you know, this is solid. This is solid. Not like, okay, pull the trigger early and then, you know, he fluffs around throughout the season. And then when the team goes, oh, well, you know, we signed you. And then it's kind of like waffling.
Really?
I have no experience in what the driver's mind is or Lewis Hamilton's mind is, but for me, I probably would like see whether the team, it works both ways, whether the driver wants to see how he's performing through the season or how the team sees the driver performing, because it all comes down to money at the end of the day.
Really talking to him though, it just does seem that this is something he wants to get done and over with so he can focus on like racing. You have to take into consideration that these guys are hired guns, right? And let's say that this hired gun doesn't have a very good season and you're in a contract year. Yeah. Now all of a sudden your stock level just went from being superstar to crap.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it can happen to you in Formula One in an instant. If you're an F1 driver, you always want to try and get the best deal possible as soon as possible because you have no idea what's going to happen next. And so for a guy like Lewis at the top of his game, obviously, he's going to want to pump Mercedes and Daimler for whatever they're worth. He wants something that's going to be bigger than what he's going to get. And I think he'd be satisfied with that, in all honesty. I really feel that getting something just above what he has right now, that'll satisfy him. I mean, let's talk about it. He's one of the highest paid athletes in the world right now.
Yeah.
He's also, and I think I don't know that there'd be much of a disagreement to this, but I think he's also the best businessman in the sport.
Yeah, he's very smart on the business side, 100%. For sure. Yeah.
He knows, and I don't know that there's, again, much disagreement to this, but he's really the only transcendent star that the sport has. And that's another conversation about the risk to the sport when he eventually departs. But I think he knows his value. Mm-hmm. I think having a conversation with Ferrari doesn't hurt anything. It just increases his leverage when he negotiates with Mercedes. But I think at his age, I would be looking for security and comfort, and I think he'll probably be the highest paid Formula One driver ever. Mm-hmm. And I think what we've seen with Max signing that 3-year deal and with Charles inking that 4-year deal is he's now got a baseline that he can take to Mercedes, because I don't know that they would have been comfortable signing more than a 2 or 3 year deal. But I think honestly, the checkbook should be and will probably be open to him at this stage in his career. Yeah. And if I'm him, I need to get this done now, because if the 2020 season starts and Valtteri Bottas begins to run away with the title and he's putting significant ground between the two of us, you know, that's probably not going to help my negotiating capabilities. I want to sign that deal now, and I want as long term as possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's why I found Christian Horner's comments about a month or 6 weeks ago very fascinating. He thought that by the time the contract situation got sorted out for 2021, that it was going to be status quo. Yeah. And I thought, okay, well, it's just going to depend on who pulls the trigger first. We had Charles and we had Max. Yeah. And then I'm like, okay, well, it seems like it's going to be that way. But just going back to Lewis, as tantalizing and as fascinating as I find that whole seventh world championship and then the move to the Ferrari, I just have a real problem reconciling that and seeing Lewis move from Mercedes and going to Ferrari to do that. It just seems to me, I mean, those ties with Mercedes go a long way back with Lewis Hamilton. And I just have
back to go-karting.
Exactly. Yep. And I really just can't foresee a situation to break off that relationship, even just for a couple of years, you know, to at the end of the career there. I just can't see it happen.
You made a great point, because there's immediate upfront value in Lewis re-upping with Mercedes, and the value is the contract and the immediate sponsorship opportunities. But more than that, and you made a great point, is that there's a lifelong ambassadorship role
100%.
that tie-in that he would have for them with the rest of his career. So whether he's in racing or not, whether he's competing, whether he's in the press, whether he's producing music, whatever he wants to do, there'll be a linkage and a tie-up between him and Mercedes forever. And that could be valuable in itself, even if he's not in a race car. Mm-hmm. But if he severs that relationship and he goes to Ferrari, that opportunity is done. It's over.
Let's say, you know, let's talk about Lewis and Mercedes being like, you know, Schumacher and Ferrari, right? We always have known Formula One and Ferrari, those two being associated with each other forever. We've always known that, right? What if we were now to start to associate, because the younger generation is, that Mercedes and Formula One, that sounds more like they're starting to amalgamate and come together, when in fact it used to be Ferrari and Formula One. We're now starting to kind of feel more like it's starting to be like, hey, you know, Mercedes has been in F1 for blah, 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 the Silver Arrows. Let's go all the way back to whenever, right? They're starting to bring all these things back. Lewis is amazing. He's won this. Mercedes has smashed every single record that we know of. Lewis is on his way to pretty much being number one in every single driver's category, right? And then tying Schumacher for seven. Like, so it just kind of all sort of makes sense. And you have to think that there is no chance that Daimler's not going to keep pouring money into this program to make these headlines. They make billions of dollars off of this stuff every year. You know, they're pumping money into it, yes, but they're making a ton out of it. Like, they just, like, it's,
well, you know, the old saying, sense. Win on Sunday, sell on Monday.
100%. Right? It works like that. It's like clockwork at Mercedes that way, right? So it's, that's why it just doesn't even, it doesn't make sense for him to leave Mercedes and go to Ferrari. That just doesn't work.
Yeah.
Like, on so many different levels, it just does not work. One, he probably is not going to get the type of money that he's going to get at Mercedes. He's going to pay back up to Charles Leclerc because he's now a superstar boy. And so it's kind of like, it only makes sense. That's why I think this deal gets done sooner than later. I think, like you had said, you know, it started with Charles Leclerc with the contract, and now the dominoes are just going to start to fall.
I very much agree. Yeah, the
100%.
The fascinating ones are, what happens to Bottas? What happens to Sebastian Vettel?
Those are the ones that are going to be.
And if they move on from Mercedes or Ferrari, who comes in and takes those seats? That is the very fascinating.
That's exactly
question.
What I was going to say. Yeah. Those are the conversations that I get excited about, because it's like, you got George Russell, Mercedes Academy driver. He's right down pit lane. If he has a good season at Williams, why don't you just bring George? You've been paying for George's time at Williams. Bring him over here and, you know, put him there. And then Bottas, well, you're on your own.
To put somewhere Pascal Wehrlein saying, remember me, I'm here too.
Well, he's simulator driver now, Ferrari, right? He re-upped with them, so he's back in their sim.
To put it into context, Ferrari's last driver title was before the global economic crisis. It was 3 years before the Vancouver Olympics. It's been an eternity.
Yeah, a long time.
Well, you know, so in Maranello, every time Mercedes win a race or a championship, you know, they're pulling their hair out. And that's what just makes Mercedes' dominance over the past 5 or 6 years that much more incredible. I mean, it's like clockwork. And the thing that really impresses upon me is every time they win a race, is those people there at the track, they still look just as happy as the first race that they won. You know, they genuinely look like a group of people that love what they're doing. They love going racing, and they're excited every time they win a race, because every time they're up there on the podium, it's always somebody different beside Lewis or Valtteri or Nico Rosberg going back a couple of years. And it looks like they're always having a lot of fun out there.
Tim, you made a point that I'd never processed before, which is, Mercedes has done this great job in the turbo hybrid era of cultivating a fan base that knows only Mercedes as a winner. If you're 20,
you only know Mercedes as a winner. Yeah, you don't know anything else.
You don't know Ferrari.
No, you don't know the history. You don't know the legacy.
You don't remember Kimi Raikkonen winning in 2007. Yeah. You've probably heard of Schumacher, but that's like a 20-year-old kid today hearing about Michael Jordan. Like, okay, I get it. The Bulls and Jordan were great.
Yeah, now look at the Bulls and Jordan. Like,
I know the Golden State Warriors and Steph Curry.
Or even Hamilton winning for McLaren. And where's McLaren? McLaren this past season stepped it up, but, you know, before before Hamilton's jump from McLaren to Mercedes, they would have never have known that McLaren, because if they jumping into Formula One now, McLaren is just getting their footing back again. Totally. And then, you know, it's really impressive.
So tomorrow, like, I think you made a, an interesting point there. But I just think, I just think that Mercedes is, it's just they're a brand, they're a product. They represent they're the perfect blend as well. They represent a German manufacturer, a global powerhouse that withstood the global economic crisis like no other manufacturers did. They're, and for all intents and purposes, they're a British-based team, and they have the most transcendent star in the sport. Mm-hmm. No other driver is like him, and you don't see these type of personalities come across very often. And I think one of the things that Formula One sometimes struggles with is cultivating a fan base and creating broad appeal. And that's something that Chase Carey and Liberty are going to have to wrestle with and work through, because Bernie was doing the exact opposite of broadening appeal, which I think most people would agree with. But Lewis, you have this opportunity with this driver, and I don't think Bernie did enough, and I think Liberty will do more. But as long as he's in the sport, you want him associated with your principal brand, and you want to do everything you can to expose him and leverage him as an advertising and marketing vehicle.
Yeah, well, it really is interesting. You bring up Bernie Ecclestone there, because I remember reading a Bernie quote a couple of years ago. He said something to the effect here, and I'm going to parse a little bit. And he said, "I'm not interested in the 20-year-old. He said, "I'm interested in the 70-year-old that already has a ton of money."
Rolex watch.
Yeah. It's the Rolex quote, and you saw that on the tracks. Like, it would drive me crazy as a spectator. Like, I get it, but that's not the demo that you want to be watching your sport. That's not the future of your sport.
Times change. Like, he's old school, and, you know, Formula One a few decades ago is not how Formula One and the market and the fans are today. Yeah. Completely different.
Yeah.
You know, look at how NASA and SpaceX has come back. Like, you know, the whole space thing was totally like dull and done, but you know, Elon Musk and SpaceX, you know, totally revived the whole like NASA and rockets and space and stuff. And
I mean, what Bernie did with Formula One over 40 years was absolutely remarkable.
No,
I mean, to bring it to the pinnacle.
But it's a different
time.
It's a different
time. Exactly. Yeah.
But Lewis, so I hate to use this analogy, but our son has a 21-year-old godmother. So I kind of have insight into that younger demo mindset by talking to her. And I see the way that she dresses, and I see the way that she talks, and I see the music that she listens to, and the way that she interacts with her friends. And that's all Lewis. Like, Lewis speaks that language. Vettel doesn't. Ricardo doesn't necessarily do it. Some of the younger drivers do, like Albon and Leclerc and Gasly.
Yeah.
They're definitely fit that younger demo, but their appeal isn't broad enough to break out of the sport.
Lewis definitely gets it. And the interesting thing about Lewis is that, like you said, he transcends the sport a little bit, because I know a lot of people that know nothing about Formula One, but they know Lewis Hamilton. And then I'll ask him, okay, well, who is Lewis Hamilton? Yeah, he's a racing driver or something. I mean, it's almost like they know him because he's famous, but they don't know what he's done.
Yeah, a big part of it too is the times now with social media, with technology. Ecclestone didn't have to deal with that a few decades back, right? There was no social media back then. There was no Instagram.
Yep.
You know, everything is now accessible to younger viewers. This generation, they're seeing it on YouTube. They're seeing it on TV, online. Everything's accessible.
But that now is only because of Liberty. Mm. So if you look at Bernie did everything he could to clamp down on it.
Yep.
Because if they're not paying for it, they being the audience, they're not getting it. And it was only when Liberty kind of lifted up that iron curtain and allowed the spectators to have some backstage access that we began to see that. But you're right. It was a different era.
Yeah. All right. Well, we've sat here for 45 minutes now talking about Ferrari and Mercedes. There are eight other teams in Formula One.
Really?
And we've touched on a couple of them a little bit. But the other team that's missing from this conversation so far is Red Bull, and Max Verstappen, obviously the big star there. And well, this is another one I'm going to ask you guys to look into the crystal ball here. And how soon, or is it going to happen, when we see the combination of Red Bull, Honda, and Max Verstappen win a world championship?
What about Alex Albon?
I like Alex Albon. He did in 9 races, I think, was fantastic.
Let me tell you something about Alex Albon.
I'm listening.
That kid is quick. Like, very quick.
Yeah.
He's the real deal. I think if the car works out the way that he thinks it's going to work out to be this season, I think Max is going to have his hands full. In all honesty, Alex is he's a tremendous driver, and I honestly believe that people are definitely sleeping on him.
It's interesting because I think that Pierre Gasly maybe gets a little bit of like, I mean, criticism is warranted, but I think a lot of it has been harsh. I think he's a good driver, but I think that he was maybe a bit of a square peg in a round hole, or maybe the timing just wasn't right for him to go from Toro Rosso to Red Bull. And it just like he never really got into his groove there.
The car wasn't like just designed for him, right? We have to remember that the Red Bull's making these cars designed for Max in his driving style and the way he drives, right? They're not designing these cars for Daniel Ricciardo. They're not designing these cars for Pierre Gasly and the way Gasly drives. It's kind of like, okay, second driver, here you go. This is what you got. Figure it out. You're on your own. And if you crash, see you later because your ass is out the door. Yeah. With Red Bull, I think bringing Gasly up the way that they did, I thought that they did a great job. I thought they gave him a good opportunity. I don't think Gasly was able to figure out the car fast enough. I think that crash in testing set him back huge. And I think it set his confidence back as well. And I think it set him back so far that it took going back to Toro Rosso, being in a car that actually was more developed for him than it was for Danny Kvyat, to really get that confidence back and to learn the tire and to just understand what those operating windows are. Because, being at Red Bull, he just couldn't figure it out. He just couldn't figure out the tire, couldn't figure it out, couldn't get the confidence. And then it's like we were just saying at the beginning of the show, it's like a downward spiral from there, right, as an athlete. So I think for Pierre Gasly, I think if he has another great year at Toro Rosso, there is, Alex Albon doesn't have a great year. Hey, why not just swap him back? Totally. Or even Danny Kvyat. I think Red Bull's got a good situation with their drivers. But again, it's just all going to come down to if Albon can figure out that Red Bull car, because we know Max Verstappen's going to be able to drive it.
Yeah, for sure.
Let's be honest here. Well, we know that car's being built for him.
Getting back to your original question, I see Verstappen winning the championship with Red Bull, not soon, but in the next maybe 3, 4, 5 years. I see Max Verstappen as a young Sebastian Vettel. He still needs to mature. Once he gets that maturity, then he's going to win championships just like Vettel did when he was with Red Bull.
And he's matured so much already.
Oh, he had that benchmark moment in 2018. He had a rough start to the season. Yeah. He had that shunt in, what was it, FP3 in Monaco.
Once he got to Canada, he turned it around.
Exactly.
He's been unbelievable ever since that race, ever since the Canadian Grand Prix 2018. He's been lights out. And there's no question why he shouldn't be. He's an amazing talent.
Absolutely.
Yeah. We were talking earlier today as well just about what he's achieved as a 22-year-old.
Oh, unbelievable.
It's unreal because we feel like he's 26 or 27 or 28 because he's been in the sport forever.
So much
but he's put in 4 full seasons and he's 22.
Yeah.
Like he's accomplished more by 22 than Lewis had, than Sebastian Vettel had, than Schumacher had. Yeah. And he's still only 22. This is when a lot of young drivers are still making that transition from F3 to F2.
Yeah, he did go F3 to straight into F1 and he was absolutely spectacular. He had no fear. Like some of the passes, he had a couple in Spa that I was just like, God, I had to turn away from the TV and stop looking. But
well, we had Brazil a couple of years ago in the rain. I mean, where he was finding grip in the wet was amazing. Yeah,
but I think just to repeat what you've said, like I think for Max, he's his own worst enemy. Like when he matures more or when he composes himself on the track, I think that's when he's going to start blowing away everybody. But he's sometimes a loose cannon. He'll be like yammering on the radio and. Yeah. And then some of it is his fault, but yet he's flacking on somebody else.
You know what? That's one of the things that I love about Max Verstappen is that he has this "I don't give a bleep" attitude, and I don't care what you think of me, and I don't care what you think of what I do on the racetrack because I'm going to do it.
And that's what I associate with
love it.
Sebastian Vettel in his early days.
A young Vettel.
Young Vettel. Yeah. Every time I hear Max Verstappen go off like that, that reminds me of Vettel 10 years ago.
But Vettel never went to those, I was in a media conference with, who was on the stage? It was Lance Stroll, there was Max Verstappen, and there was Valtteri Bottas. I think that's who it was. And a reporter had asked Verstappen, why do you crash so much? And his response was, I think I've had enough with these questions, and the next person to ask me again why I crashed so much is I'm going to headbutt them. And I'm like, that is awesome. I mean, who else is going to say that, right? Like, I've never heard Sebastian Vettel say something like that. Yeah. It's just kind of like, I hate to put those two together. You know what I mean? Even when Vettel was young, Vettel would never say something like that, right?
That's
why I love Verstappen. I love his attitude. It's a breath of fresh air into Formula One, just like Daniel Ricciardo is, just like Lewis Hamilton is his own personality. And I love that Red Bull kind of just lets Max go and be Max.
Maybe it's because, so Verstappen had a very different youth than a lot of these other drivers. Like we've heard so much about Lewis Hamilton. He grew up in a middle-class family in Stevenage. You know, it wasn't all, he had to earn every step of his journey. He had to earn it by winning and winning and winning and building those relationships with corporate partners. Max's development was different because his father was a Formula One driver. Mm-hmm. So maybe for him, for a lot of these drivers, like they recognize that it's an immense privilege to be here because I'm trailblazing for my family, my friends, my country. Yeah. For Max, it's like, I've been here all my life.
Yeah.
Like
he feels entitled. He's one of those millennials that's like,
but he
I'm
backs
entitled.
It up. And
I'm
he backs
entitled.
It up 100% because he wins on the track. But just to kind of wrap up that Alex Albon piece, I think the entire story and the narrative around Alex Albon is incredible. And I urge people, if you haven't listened to his interview on Beyond the Grid, his story coming
incredible.
Out of F2, being
absolutely
resigned
incredible.
To the fact that, and you know what, he talks about how people were reaching out to him at the end of that F2 season, congratulating him on the fact that he got a ride in Formula E.
He almost didn't even finish the F2 season.
And he's psychologically, like, I'm psychologically resigned to going to Formula E because no one makes that transition from Formula E to Formula One. If you're in Formula E, that's it. That's where the Sorokins go. That's where the end of season or end of career Felipe Massa go. But his story is amazing. And then he gets that call up and he has a great start at the season with Toro Rosso. And then he makes the transition to a surprise transition to Red Bull. And then he just posts four, five, six, these unbelievable finishes for the entire back half of the season. And he does it seemingly without breaking a sweat. Like, I cannot wait to see what he does this year. Mm-hmm. I cannot wait to see.
Well, there's a lot of interesting things going on at Red Bull. You've got the resurgence of Honda. You've got Max Verstappen and Alex Albon. You have a design team headed by Adrian Newey. There are a lot of really important people in the right places there. And Max even said just in the last week or so that he wants to win a championship there. And I think it's really fascinating the way that his career has gone, because a couple of years ago when he was just breaking in, there was some possibility, I think it was he could have been a reserve driver at Mercedes or something like that. But I think the way that they've kind of managed and steered his career so far, I think they've really put him into a really good spot at a very, very young age. Because my takeaway from this discussion over the past 5 or 10 minutes is, and this is what has been my theory, my ruling, whatever you want to call it, about Max, is that incredibly young driver, and a lot of the mistakes that we've seen him do or have, and a lot of things that have happened, is because we've basically watched this guy grow up in front of our eyes, literally in real time. And that's why going back to 2018 and that Monaco Grand Prix, what he's done since is absolutely phenomenal. Yeah. But I think that it's going to be really fun to watch and see where they go this year with Honda, because last year was that sort of benchmark season. They go from Renault, they go to Honda, and the goal last year was for Honda to basically put them in the same position where they were under Renault and deliver similar results, which they more or less accomplished. And I think the latter half of the season with Albon and Verstappen is probably what it should have been like the entire year if Gasly was able to figure it out over those opening 10, 12 races or whatever it was. And I think that if Gasly had figured it out, I have a feeling that they would have been... I think they would have given Ferrari a real run for their money in the constructors. And I think that if it had worked out differently, they could have been runners up.
But I agree.
Yeah, very, very fascinating. And it's going to be kind of fun to watch, especially when you hear like some of the senior guys at Honda say that they see a lot of similarities between Max Verstappen and a young Ayrton Senna. I mean, Senna is still that guy that's still apart and on a pedestal apart from everyone else. I mean, we all know what Schumacher did in his career. And of course, course, we'll never know truly what Senna could have accomplished mm-hmm. because tragically his life mm-hmm. was cut short. But it's going to be a fun year to watch Red Bull and Verstappen and Albon for sure.
The Honda relationship, I think, is going to be fascinating as well.
Thank you for bringing that up.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to this, and I'm really looking forward to seeing what Honda brings to the track in February for preseason testing, because hearing from the team lately, it sounds as though, you know, things are going in the right direction. The engines are also going in the right direction as well. I think, you know, one of the big problems that, you know, Red Bull had previously was how the with Renault and everything, and how that engine was packaged and gave that to them. And they had to redesign a lot of the car just to get proper airflow coming over the car because the engines were too big and they didn't give them the proper dimensions for the actual engine to fit in the housing that they had already built. So for Red Bull, having a relationship that is this strong with Honda, where they actually have a legit engine manufacturer to work with, not to say that Renault is not a legit engine manufacturer. I think Renault is awesome, and they obviously have a number of titles, and they're amazing. But Honda itself, to have an engine manufacturer to work one-on-one with, and to be able to build your car together with an engine manufacturer is an extremely, extremely important thing. Because one of the things I think that people lose sight of is that, you know, these teams that are customer teams who, you know, lease their engines from, you know, Haas gets theirs from Ferrari and Williams gets theirs from Mercedes. You have to remember that those engines are being built for a Mercedes. They're not being built for a Williams, right? So the size and the dimensions are specifically geared towards what their cars are going to be like. They're not specifically geared towards what a Williams is going to be like. So Williams has to kind of, you know, they have to come in and massage, and they have to make adjustments to the car and inches here and inches there, and they start losing certain things like downforce or airflow. So having an engine manufacturer to work one-on-one with is huge, and I think that is what's going to put Red Bull above everyone this year. Yeah.
It's a flashback to 2010, 2011, 2012, 2013, when Red Bull ran off those four titles with Sebastian Vettel because Renault was producing their engines, Renault, for all intents and purposes, didn't have a team of their own.
That was a one-on-one sort of thing. Yeah, exactly.
And only when Renault re-entered the sport did that relationship begin to fray a little bit. And they've managed to reconstruct that exact same dynamic now with Honda. And I also think, and I don't want to underestimate the importance, but I think it's really important for Formula One that they have these really significant manufacturers producing engines. Because I don't know how committed Renault is to the sport. Ferrari's going to be there because financially they're motivated to be there. Mercedes, I think, is going to be there, but you can't have a three-engine sport. You need to have those four teams. Yeah. So it's to the benefit of the sport if Honda can produce a competitive power unit. And that's exactly what we saw last year, which is why I'm not a huge Max Verstappen fan, but I was ecstatic when he was winning races because it meant that Honda had achieved something of significance with that
team. There's more dynamics in the sport, in the race. Like, you know, everyone's working with their own tools. They're not working with somebody else's tools and somebody else's engine. So that's what brings the dynamicity into the sport. And that's what I get excited about is, hey, can they beat so-and-so team with what they've got, not with what the same team that they're racing against has got, right? So
A bit of an interesting sidebar here. A couple of months ago, I was going through my Facebook and one of these memories came up. So I'm like, okay, I want to see what I was doing on this day, like X number of years ago. And it comes up from November, October, 2013. It says, just finishing watching Sebastian Vettel win his third world title. I'm like, oh my God, I do not remember watching that race. I do not remember that happening. And then what really freaked me out about it was, I don't remember him winning title number four.
That's so funny.
I know. But anyways, going back to Renault and Honda, but that clearly was a relationship that had gone past its best before date. Because
okay, well, there you have it. That is part one of the F1 roundtable that I had with Tim Haraney of TSN and Mark and Gill of the Flash F1 podcast. And I hope you guys really enjoyed that. Like I said, off the top of the show, part two will drop early next week after the weekend. And also there will be a regular show towards the end of the week when the program usually drops. So I hope you guys will check out both of those. And the roundtable goes on. We talk a little bit more about Red Bull and what we expect to see from them in 2020. We talk at length about the two Canadian drivers we're going to see in F1 this year in Lance Stroll and Nicholas Latifi, because Tim has been able to talk with them on a number of occasions and gives us some really good insight. And of course, no roundtable would be complete without some predictions and crystal ball gazing into what we might see in 2020, both on and off the track. And also, we make some predictions as to who might be world champion next year. Some predictions may be somewhat predictable, and some may be a little bit unexpected or maybe surprising. I'll let you guys decide that. Anyways, if you want to get in touch between now and then, you can do so by sending me a tweet at ScuderiaF1Pod, or you can send me an email at ScuderiaF1Pod@gmail.com. Anyways, thank you for downloading and listening to the show, and we'll catch you guys again this time next week. Bye for now.
Thanks for listening to the Scuderia F1 Podcast. If you want to get the show notes for this episode, then head over to ScuderiaF1Pod.com. Want to get in touch with us? Then email us at ScuderiaF1Pod@gmail.com.
Welcome to another round of Boardroom or Miro Board. Today we talk retrospectives with Agile coach Maria. Let's go. First question. You've spent 2 hours in a team retro, but the only input you've heard is Dave's. Boardroom or Miro Board?
Boardroom. In Miro, Dave can't hog the space because everyone can add thoughts anonymously, online, at the same time.
Correct. Next. You need the team to act on feedback fast, so you turn all those retro notes into Jira tasks instantly.
Miro all the way. And I can assign those tasks to teammates.
You're nailing this. Now, you see hundreds of sticky notes from the retro. A real mess. But you organize them into 5 themes in just seconds.
Miro, I basically get back an entire hour when I use its AI tools for clustering.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people running actually enjoyable and actionable retros in Miro. Get your first 3 boards free at Miro.com. That's M-I-R-O.com.